Also in the UK, Shadow Foreign Secretary David Lammy, the man who abstained from voting for a ceasefire motion in the British Parliament months ago, tells Parliament an Israeli offensive in Rafah will be catastrophic. Backed by the US, EU and the UK, Israel has killed nearly 35,000 Palestinians and wounded more than 78,000 others in Gaza alone since October last year. Okay, let's have a deeper dive with my guests in the studio, political analyst and businesswoman, Bushra Sheikh, and from Ontario, Canada, political analyst, Dr. Ali Mala. Welcome back, everybody. Let me start with you, Bushra. The assault on Rafah, it was supposed to be a red line to the international community, Joe Biden, the American president's red line, and yet here we are. Do you think that it'll be possible at this point for the international community, for the Americans, to prevaricate on Gaza and what Israel has been committing there?
I'd like to say yes to that, and I'd like to have and be hopeful, as millions of people across the globe are trying to be. The honest truth is, from my own perception, is I feel like the intention to get into Rafah in the way that they are has always been there from the start. It's been a very insincere discussion that we've been seeing happen. In fact, I think a lot of the political ministers in general, Biden's cabinet, all the ministers in Israel, even in the UK to a certain degree, have been posturing around the entire situation and actually not coming clean with what the intentions were for Gaza. And part of the kind of rougher onslaught has been there from the beginning. This is ultimately what they were trying to do from the start. They had no intentions of not doing this.
We'll come to Western and U.S. support for Israel. Come back to it a little later. But let me put the next question to Ali. There was a ceasefire deal. Hamas agreed to it. There were celebrations in the Gaza Strip that after so many months and so many deaths, it would eventually come to an end. And yet, Tel Aviv has rejected it, this ceasefire deal brokered by the Qataris and the Egyptians. Why do you think Netanyahu decided to do that?
Because Netanyahu has come out as a big loser in this war and massacre against Gaza and the people of Gaza. He has nothing to show off. He has nothing so far to offer to the Israeli society, who is so divided against the government direction and the political situation, plus the military situation, whether in Gaza or even inside Palestine. So I think he was playing game and trying to muscle his way through to convince whoever is not being convinced yet that they lost the war in Gaza. And an earlier statement of yours about red line, are we supposed to be there were red lines, you know, by the American and the UK and the others? I doubt that very much, because without the ongoing support by the U.S. administration and the UK rulers and the rest of the Western world, I don't think, you know, Netanyahu or the Zion state as a whole would defy the international community and the whole world by continuing its massacres against the people of Gaza.
But Ali, help me understand this. So there is this ceasefire deal. Despite that, the Israelis, the occupation forces, have launched these attacks on eastern Rafah as we speak. People dying, of course, there, being killed. And on the other hand, sending negotiators to Egypt to continue with the negotiations. What is the purpose of that? Is it aimed at getting better ceasefire terms, do you think, or is just a smokescreen for the Israeli military preparations to launch that long-awaited and feared invasion of Gaza?
Could be both. You know, could be a possibility to reposition the government of the state of Israel situation, and also could be a real attempt to arrive to something with Gaza. But unfortunately, you know, we never believed their genuine attempts to have a permanent ceasefire, and that's why, you know, they came out and attacked, you know, the eastern part of Rafah and embarking on imposing more sufferings on the Palestinians. Keep in mind that the government is very fragmented, pulling out on various direction, including, you know, key ministers. And keep also in mind, this is the longest ever war the Zion states had been engaged with. We are almost 8 months there. It never happened in the history of the Zion state, and the hostage or some of them still there. They couldn't achieve a military victory over 2.7 kilometers of resistance. And it's a big defeat to Netanyahu himself, and big defeat to the government and their allies as well outside the region. So therefore, it's like, you know, he's like jumping all over the places. He wanna try to have it both end, but this, it won't work. Because now, you know, the resistance, Hamas saying, you know, the peace talk is almost off, as long as the incursion on Rafah is still going on.
And of course, they definitely wouldn't want to sign on to a deal that would mean handing over the captives, losing their only remaining trump card, if you will, in all of this, only for Israel to start pummeling Gaza again. Governments may not be taking action, backers of Israel, but people have made themselves clear here in the UK included. Anger, frustration, and passion were all running high in London, outside the British Prime Minister's residence at Downing Street earlier this week. Protesters were out in force for an emergency demo to push back against British complicity in the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from the Gaza Strip. At a hands-off Rafah demo, protesters called for an end to the bombardment of Rafah and on the UK to stop all arms sales to Israel.
We should stop funding Israel, stop arming Israel. Sunak today said that he was deeply concerned, but we want more than concern. We want action. We want to stop to the slaughter in Gaza. Hamas has supported a ceasefire proposal. Israel should support that proposal too, and Britain should insist and indeed demand that it does.
There's reports that the US are apparently withholding some bombs from the kind of standard shipments of armaments that go to Israel. That's obviously nowhere near enough, but it's another indication that this doesn't count for nothing. You know, this, at the very least, this, I think it allows us to set a line to say how far things are allowed to go. But of course, we need to push that much further.
I felt the need to be here because people in Gaza have got nowhere to go. As the IDF move into Rafah, there is nowhere left for them to go. And so we cannot just keep saying eyes on Rafah even. Something has to happen. So that's why we're here outside Downing Street, because we need the government not just to condemn it in words, but to condemn it in actions. And the world will follow. We need that first move.
Israelis are just not listening to anybody. They're determined to ethnically cleanse the whole population of Jaffa, or I don't know where they expect them to go. They've nowhere left to run. They're trapped, and they've started bombing them. And it's just appalling. And I just couldn't, in all conscience, sit at home and do nothing. So I had to come here today to protest.
What the IDF is doing now is just bombing the innocent children, the elderly people, the women, the helpless citizens. This is something which coward people do. The solution is just a man-to-man confrontation. This is all we want. But to killing the innocent people is something unacceptable in any religion, in, like, it's just unacceptable.
Well, the people aren't going to stop, you know. We won't stop until Palestine is free, and hopefully in our lifetimes. I think globally the movement has picked up so much. I've heard parts of it throughout my life, but, like, I'm British. I've grown up in a sheltered world. I haven't had to face realities and too much hardship, you know. But I really think, especially amongst the youth, like, no one doesn't know what's happening, you know. And I really believe that the minds of the masses are changing, and that
young people have a sense of morality and can see evil when it's in front of their eyes. I just wish our older political leaders had such clear vision as our students.
Well, the majority of Britons, of course, favor an immediate permanent ceasefire in the Gaza Strip. Let me go straight to Bushra now. Explain, Bushra, help me understand how, despite 7 months of these hostilities there and the bloodshed of weekend protests and protests during the week. Admission by the UK Foreign Secretary David Cameron that he feared Israel was in breach of international law. Of course, there's overwhelming evidence that that is the case. And yet, arms deals, licenses between the UK and Israel have not ceased.
Absolutely. I mean, we have to look at the fact that the UK is complicit in all of this simply because Israel and the USA, they are all allies. They are going to support each other. If you think about the kind of capitalism, well, the way that the world is structured, we always look at economy. They're not going to stop the sales of arms. They are not going to do that right now because that's actually showing something which is against what Israel is actually trying to do. The fact that we have millions of people protesting this, the fact that it is okay for certain individuals to let innocent lives continually get killed shows the part of our leadership that is so disconnected from the global public. It's actually very frightening. We were saying about the scenes that are coming out of Rafah right now. You would think that they would stop arms sales to Israel, but a part of me just feels like there are individuals in this world who are just corrupted souls, and there is nothing that you can do about that, and mm-hmm. that is exactly what we're seeing.
Mm-hmm. And Ellie, about these demonstrations that have been going on forever, not just here in the UK, at major cities around the world, the sense you get based on what we just heard earlier by those demonstrators is that the Israelis and their backers have not only lost this ongoing genocidal war militarily, but also in terms of public opinion as well.
Of course, and morally they have no legs to stand on. As you know, in the U.S., in many universities, you know, the brave and young students on many campuses have taken a stance, and which remind, you know, the world of, you know, the Vietnam War syndrome, where it was the student movement that really put a kind of pressure on the administration and on the American rulers at the time to really, have a second thought about it. And also as a Canadian here in Canada, you know, we salute all the students from University of British Columbia to McGill and Concordia University in Montreal to University of Ottawa to University of Toronto to McMaster. Those students are really taking a stance against, you know, not only the war, but also the whole narrative, the whole Zionist narrative, yeah. You know, when it comes to the history of the region. And just if you allow me, is it true the rulers, you know, of the West are disconnected, or they are really part of the Zionist narratives? Mm-hmm. You know, let's keep in mind, you know, we've seen like millions of people demonstrating in the streets of London and, you know, in the rest of the UK, you know, from the days of the Iraq war. And we end up with the same bunch of politicians, whether at both, you know, political parties, the same in the U.S., and almost the same here in Canada, which really begs the question, is those, you know, rulers, when I say rulers in terms of administration, regardless the color of the party in power, are they part of the imperialist, aggressive Zionist agenda, or just don't get it? I doubt that. I think they get it. They are profiteering from it. Politically and financially when it comes to corporation and rewards. But at the end of the day, you know, they will be in the dark chapter of the history.
And as we heard Bushra say earlier, there are individuals out there in the world who are corrupt to the core. I was going to ask you one final question in this segment quickly before we look at the student protests here. And that is, we saw the violent crackdown in the States on the student protesters there, Columbia University in particular, Texas, elsewhere. How has the Canadian government treated the student-led protests in Canada?
It's a very interesting question because, the administrative of McGill and Concordia University have applied for injunction against the students, and good to the Supreme Court of Canada has rejected that. So when the premier of Quebec called on the police to really intervene, he was met with a huge protest because the court of law said no. The same at the University of Toronto campus, The administration have not applied for any permit, but they are engaging in some discussion with the student leadership, especially about divestment and, you know, like really opening the books, what kind of deals they have, you know, with various Israeli companies. There was literally no brutal crackdown yet. Yeah. Is it going to remain like this? We hope so, because the community support, and when I say the community, I don't mean the Arabs, I don't mean Muslim, because many of the leaders of those student movement, you know, at campuses are, you know, very diverse, and, you know, mainly Jewish, Christian, Arab, you know, and Arab, etc. And the support they are getting, you know, from the necessities, from everything, it's like sending a message to the politician, you know, like enough is enough, and we are behind them, and, you know, we will support them.
And so far, it seems that message has fallen on deaf ears. Let's talk about the protests here, student-led protests demanding that universities sever ties with the Israeli regime over its genocidal war on Gaza have spread across Europe, and British universities are no exception. At the Oxford University encampment, one of several across the UK, we met a cohort of like-minded students protesting against institutional backing of Israel. We asked them why they thought their university's silence and what they wanted to see happen.
I think especially as a medical student, what's been really shocking is just seeing how indiscriminate these attacks have been. I'm sure you're aware of the mass graves that have been found in front of both the Al-Nasser hospitals and the Al-Shifa hospitals. And, you know, you find doctors, nurses in there with patients who still have cannulas in their arms, still have catheters inserted. And I think as someone who wants to go into this field where in Gaza to be a doctor is a crime for which you will pay by death a lot of the time, I think has been really shocking. And the fact that this institution and this university, which has such a big name and such its words have such gravity, not only in the kind of local community, but across the world, I think particularly our silence has been really, really shocking to me.
Our demands are broadly under four different tenets. The first is disclosure. So this university currently has no mechanism for students and staff to access where their money is going. That means pension funds for staff, and that means tuition fees for students. And we think that that's really wrong, not even just from the Palestine context, but in general. The second are our divestment demands. We have two. The first is that the university should divest from all arms companies. We don't think that universities should be sponsoring conflict anywhere in the world. The second is specifically that this university divest from all companies that are complicit in Israeli occupation, apartheid, and the genocide in Gaza. Then we move on to our boycott demands, which again are kind of a boycott of all companies involved, and specifically a demand to drop Barclays Bank, which has been identified by the global BDS movement as a specific target. And finally, we call for the university to support the Palestinian-led rebuilding of the Gazan higher education sector.
Meanwhile, the devastation in Rafah has meant thousands of previously displaced families are forced to flee once more in search of shelter in the face of Israeli occupation forces' attacks. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, says children are particularly vulnerable, and while some critical needs are being met, access is becoming increasingly difficult and dangerous.
We don't know where to go. They told us to go to the Al-Mawasi area in Khan Yunis. We really don't know in which direction to go. This is the second time I've been displaced. I was in Deir al-Balah and our house was bombed and my granddaughter was killed. We have no one to stay with in Deir al-Balah. I was then displaced to Rafah, where my second daughter is, and now we are fleeing the area.
All right, just a few quick questions as we bring this episode to a wrap. I'll start with Bushra, UNICEF, WHO, others, leading aid bodies warning of a catastrophic impact of the Rafah offensive if it were to be pushed ahead, even by the dire standards already set in Gaza. You said you weren't optimistic earlier, but do you think there will be any last-ditch attempt at stopping this yet worse massacre?
They certainly should be. I mean, I cannot see any more innocent lives taken, any more children. The images that we're seeing, like I said before, I'm still going to remain hopeful. I feel like the veil has been lifted off of Western supremacy ideals. It's the first time in history that we are seeing this happen. The fact that I'm an advocate for students, all the protests in the universities across the Western Hemisphere that are standing up for Palestine right now, it's the first time that we are seeing this happen historically. This has got to mean something.
What do we owe that to? Is it social media? Is it the sheer number of Palestinians, women, children, men, innocent people who have been murdered in the past 7 months?
I think it's a combination of both. I think it's the first time that we are seeing this publicly displayed on a wide scale platform. We have young individuals who are actual activists who want to be part of a better world. Mm-hmm. This is the greatest thing that we have seen in universities, and I believe that nobody should be saying anything to students anymore. They have stood up for the right cause. And the question will be, what did you do? When history writes its book, what side were you on, and were you on the right side?
And Ali, paint us a picture of what it's going to look like, because we've seen enough scenes of murder and sheer destruction over the past 7 months. I mean, there is no shortage of vocabulary, really, to describe the horror of the past 7 months. If this onslaught, invasion of Rafah were to be pushed ahead or go ahead, what do you think will happen to 1.6 million, give or take, people who are trapped after having been displaced from the rest of the Gaza Strip in that part of the
What we've seen is another chapter of Zionist massacre against the Palestinian since 1948 and even before, with its terrorist organization like the Haganah and the Shtren and others. And we are only a few days, you know, away from a Nakba, which I call the continuance of resistance. So it will be a very heavy price, not only for the Palestinian, but for the rest of the international community to bear, if Israel continue with its aggression and the brutality against the Palestinian in Rafah. Because not only they have nowhere to go, but you know, the level of destruction, the lack of medical and basic needs, the dire situation with no shelters, it is a huge challenge to the so-called leaders of the international community. And if I were the president or the head of the United Nations, I would be in Rafah right now. I don't know what's preventing those people really from taking a very brave act when time is calling for it. But I remain hopeful like Bushra, because the student movement, you know, it's so universal. You know, the demand were outlined by the people interviewed on your segment. It's almost the same demand here in Canada and the U.S. and, you know, even in France and other places. So we have now a universal movement awakened to the crimes of the Zion state. And then another hope I have is the continuation of resistance, because this is the history of the Palestinian people. And, you know, they charted that in history with their blood and life, and they will continue until the liberation.
That is for sure. And that is all the time we have for this Gaza under attack. So special thanks to Bushra Sheikh and Dr. Ali Mallah for their thoughts, and to you for being with us. Until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
the limelight.
Protests have broken out at colleges and universities across the United States in connection with the ongoing brutal war in Gaza. Over 300 protesters at Harvard University have signed a letter urging the university authorities to negotiate with pro-Palestinian protesters. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster ABC News has covered this story and tells us more. Many pro-Palestinian protesters are calling for their colleges to divest of funds from Israeli military operations, while some Jewish students on campuses have called the protests anti-Semitic and said they're scared for their safety. The student protests, some of which have turned into around-the-clock encampments, have erupted throughout the nation following arrests and student removals at Columbia University in New York City. Students at schools including Yale University, New York University, Harvard University, University of Texas at Austin, University of Southern California, and many more have launched protests. Over 300 Harvard University professors have signed a letter to the university authorities urging them constructive dialogue with the peaceful protesters on campus. We are concerned that the university has yet to meet with the students to hear their concerns. Instead, the administration has issued escalating threats of punitive disciplinary action, the severity of which the university has not seen in decades, the professors wrote. They added, "We urge the administration to meet and engage in meaningful dialogue with peacefully protesting students." The letter sent to interim president of Harvard University, Alan Garber, and interim provost, John Manning, on Tuesday, came after Harvard University authorities warned protesters to empty their encampment. The professors are urging Harvard's administration to follow the lead of Brown University and Northwestern University, where encampments ended after school leadership agreed to take steps towards divestment. "I think so many of us signed this letter because, as faculty, we have a duty of care towards our students. The harshness and scale of the proposed punishment is unprecedented and, frankly, alarming. These are activities that should be met with dialogue, not punishment," Teju Cole, a Gore Vidal professor of the practice of creative writing at Harvard University, said in a statement. "We are calling on the administration to be fair-minded and set these protests in the context of numerous other protests that have happened here in the past, in response to which the university did the right thing," Cole wrote. Meanwhile, police entered an encampment at the University of Chicago early on Tuesday, 7th of May, and began dismantling it, according to Chicago ABC station WLS. Also, University of California at Los Angeles' Chancellor, Jean Block, said on Monday, 6th of May, that a detective from the Los Angeles Police Department will join the school's investigation to identify those who were involved in violence against pro-Palestinian protesters on university campus last week. The law enforcement investigation at University of California at Los Angeles is being led by Associate Chancellor and Chief Safety Officer Rick Brazil. "Its goal is to identify the perpetrators of the violence and hold them to account," Block said in a note to university community. The Chancellor of University of California at Los Angeles, Jean Block, said they have reached out to the FBI for possible assistance, as well as to Los Angeles County District Attorney Prosecution. Protesters at Massachusetts Institute of Technology are resisting orders to leave their encampment on Monday, 6th of May. Video footage from the scene shows protesters topping the barriers surrounding the encampment and linking arms. This comes after MIT President Sally Kornbluth gave students until 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time to leave the encampment on university campus. The encampment on MIT's campus on the Krege lawn has been ongoing for more than 2 weeks, according to President Sally Kornbluth. The American newspaper The Boston Herald has also covered the same story. Dozens of MIT students who refused to clear an anti-Israel encampment on university campus on Monday, 6th of May, are being suspended and referred to the Committee on Discipline, according to the university's chancellor, Melissa Nobles. Melissa Nobles did not specify the exact number of students being sanctioned, nor disclosed the institute's plan in breaking down the encampment. Her update comes after MIT President Sally Kornbluth warned student protesters in a letter that if they did not leave the Krege lawn, where tents have been set up, by 2:30 p.m. on Monday, 6th of May, they'd either be suspended or face other sanctions or both. Roughly a handful of students remained at the encampment just after 3 p.m., and tents remained standing while fenced and tarps blocked off the area. Dozens of police surrounded the entrances and monitored the area. But hundreds of pro-Palestinian protesters returned in the evening, breaking through the barriers as they continued to call for the Institute to end all research contracts sponsored by the Ministry of Defense of Israel. In the light of yesterday's actions, we write to remind students of the disciplinary consequences of disrupting our campus, Melissa Nobles wrote in the Tuesday update. As a consequence of events that have already occurred, dozens of interim suspensions and referrals to the Committee on Discipline are now in process, in accordance with the outline described in yesterday's letter from MIT President Kornbluth. As we said previously, these actions are necessary to ensure the safety of our university community. A temporary fence continued to divide the Krege lawn on Tuesday, 7th of May, with tents on one side and hundreds of small Israeli flags planted into the grass on the other side, where Israeli and Jewish students gathered in the afternoon. In her letter on Monday, MIT President Kornbluth expressed concerns for the physical safety of students as well as outside interference and potential violence in her letter. The letter cited reports of widely disseminated literature that advocates escalation with very clear instructions and suggested means. Without our 24-hour staffing, students sleeping outside overnight in tents would be vulnerable, Kornbluth wrote. And no matter how peaceful the students' behavior may be, unilaterally taking over a central portion of our campus for one side of a hotly disputed issue and precluding use by the other members of our community is not right. This situation is inherently highly unstable. The letter outlined a range of sanctions that student protesters could face if they did or did not leave the encampment voluntarily by Monday afternoon, 6th of May. They included a written warning, immediate interim academic suspension for the remainder of the semester, and exclusion of participation in commencement and co-curricular activities, and academic suspension and being kicked off the Cambridge campus immediately. At Harvard University, Interim President Alan Garber has warned of potential suspensions and sanctions over an encampment in Harvard's yard. In a letter on Monday, Alan Garber highlighted how the disruptions from the encampment have been numerous, including exams being moved elsewhere and access to Harvard Yard being sharply limited. Those who participate in or perpetuate the continuation of the encampment will be referred to involuntary leave from their schools, Garber wrote. Among other implications, students placed on involuntary leave may not be able to sit for exams, may not continue to reside in Harvard housing, and must cease to be present on university campus until reinstated. In response, more than 300 professors signed a letter by Tuesday afternoon, 7th of May, urging GABA and Interim Provost John Manning to engage with students on the substance of their demands, and have criticized the university administration for failing to speak with peaceful student protesters except to issue escalating threats of discipline. I think so many of us signed this letter because, as faculty members, we have a duty of care towards our students, creative writing professor Teju Cole said in a statement. He added, "The harshness and scale of the proposed punishment is unprecedented and frankly alarming. These are activities that should be met with dialogue and not punishment."
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome. You are listening to Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. Well, in this program, we have your questions, queries that you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your kids. And our answers are based on the Holy Quran and the narrations from Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him and his purified family. Today in our studio, we have with us Brother Miqdad to help us with more insights on Islamic upbringing. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you and welcome to all the listeners.
Well, we have been discussing about the important teenage changes that happen with children and what are the important discussions that parents need to have with these children. We discussed the physical changes and how important it is for parents to discuss those physical changes with their children. We also discussed the emotional changes, and in the previous episode, we're discussing about the sins, because this is an age, it's very tender, and in this age, it's very, very possible for teenagers to fall into different kinds of sins. And Brother Miqdad helped us understand that it's very important for parents to have the discussion about these sins, and also at the same time be very, very realistic, have realistic expectations, and at the same time discuss the concept of forgiveness as well. Do not discuss in a way that you make your child feel extremely guilty. At the same time, also discuss with them the concepts of forgiveness of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. As you said, that there are good deeds that erase the bad deeds. So, Brother Miqdad, carry on with the discussion.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Before moving on, regarding the point that you mentioned, which was a summary of what we talked about in the previous show, as we mentioned, children at this age go through emotional swings, mood swings, as they're called. And so it's important that when we have this conversation, we make sure that we take into consideration these factor of emotions. And so conversation at this age doesn't need to be very logical, technical, argument-based, right? It needs also to have a level of emotion attached to it, a level of friendliness, sensitivity, trust, respect, but also a lot of hope. One of the things that I feel, especially in religious families, usually in our shows, these radio shows, usually religious families are listening to these radio shows. And I feel that in religious families, we have this tendency to be very strict and rigid and not enough positive and not enough hopeful, right? And this lack of being hopeful, being positive, is going to have a lot of negative consequences for a child because of their teenagehood that they're going through and that emotional swing they're going through. Children can very easily go into despair, going to be very negative about themselves, believe that they're not worth anything, etc. And so as parents, when you're having this discussion, especially when we're talking about these things related to sins at this age, it's very important to make sure that we give a lot of hope, a lot of positive energy. And also, and then it's a second point in the same context, and again, it happens very much in religious families, is to ensure that we realize that progress happens gradually, right?
Mm-hmm. Growth happens gradually.
It doesn't happen
overnight.
And this is something that we very often kind of don't take into consideration. Mm-hmm. And we expect teenagers to become awliya of Allah tomorrow, right? They should be praying all the namaz on time with wudu, with all the mustahabat and the taqibat straight away from day one, okay? It's not going to happen like that. We need to realize that growth and progress happens over months and years and decades sometimes. And we need to give that space to children to grow. And our duty is to make sure that we, at every step, take them along the way at the speed and ability according to what the child has, not according to our expectation of what we want to see in our children. Obviously, we want the best for our children. We want our children to be the best in the whole world. But we need to be realistic and understand that we need to give hope and positive energy at the same time. Understand that this happens gradually. It takes time.
Right. Brother Miqdad will discuss more with you after a short while. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
IRIB English Radio presents A Priceless Gift to Parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. We are with Brother Miqdad, and we're discussing the important discussions that parents should have with the teenagers. Brother Miqdad, you said that change do not happen overnight. So parents, even if they are making efforts and having these discussions, they should not expect their teenagers to change or have that a positive change in them overnight. It's a gradual process, and it takes time. And it reminds me of the words, when you are inviting someone towards haq, towards the right path, and when you're suggesting someone towards come towards the right path, it also needs sabr. That's why you also have to suggest them to come towards sabr as well. وَتَوَاسُوا بِالْحَقِّ وَتَوَاسُوا بِالصَّبْرِ. So, Brother Miqdad, what are the more important discussions that parents can have with their children?
Before I answer that, just to kind of really emphasize, because I feel really strongly about this, having seen the negative impact of such situations.
Such expectations, right.
I remember once one of the brothers came back from one of the cities he had gone for tabligh, and he was saying he was very disappointed about the situation in that community. He was saying all the youths and generally the entire community, he said the slogan of that community is that I can't do it. He said it's not possible. He says everything that we wanted to do, organize programs, classes, how much you would encourage them, they always had an argument for not being able to do it. And they're like, no, we can't do this. This is not possible. we can't do it, we can't do it. And he was like, the slogan of the entire community was, I can't do it, this is not going to work. And he was explaining how it's so disabling, right? And so frustrating when you have individuals that just don't have hope, don't have this ability to say, look, I can do it, let's move on. And on the flip side, when you look at our scholars, when they talk to the community, when they talk to the public, they constantly remind us that you can do it, right? Mm-hmm. You are able to do it, and you will be able to do it. And it's important to, and you realize how much they give hope to the youths, how much hope and positive energy they give to the youths. And they kind of pass on this message that, you look, you are able to do it. And this is something we've learned from the Quran, we've learned from the Ahlul Bayt, that when we talk to teenagers, we need to give that level of positive energy, that level of hope, to ensure that they don't fall into despair. Even at times when you have children that are doing, for example, mistakes, they're committing sins, right? It's not because they're committing sins that you kind of remove them from Islam. I know children, for example, at this age, when they see a woman, for example, not wearing hijab, I've heard this, kids come up to me and say, she might not be a Muslim, right? But they've completely removed her from Islam just because her hijab was a bit weak.
Right.
This is not the right attitude that we have, right? This is not what the Quran teaches us. You can be a very amazing person, have a lot of faith, and be a good religious person, and at times commit mistakes and sins. And not that we are endorsing that it's okay to make sins, to make mistakes and commit sins. No, not at all. It's possible for us to be such that we don't commit any sins. But the point is this, that we need to give positive energy, that you are able to overcome those sins if you work a bit hard, but it comes gradually, it comes progressively, and as we work together slowly, slowly, we can help each other to overcome these mistakes.
Well, we'll discuss more with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We are with Brother McDowell, and we are discussing the important discussions parents need to have with the teenagers. So Brother McDowell, you were saying that the changes, the positive changes that we're expecting is a gradual process. It does not happen overnight. The most important thing that parents or the scholars need to keep in mind while discussing these important topics with the teenagers is that they give them the hopes of the positive changes, that yes, they can overcome the mistakes.
Another point that's important to remember when we talk to children and teenagers, especially at this age, about these different sins related to desires, for example, and sins related to teenagehood generally, is to make sure that we talk about these things in the right way.
All right.
Children will be talking about these things, right? So they'll be talking about the opposite gender. They'll be talking about what they've seen on TV with their friends and their people around them. And the way they'll talk about it, obviously, is very different from the way that you want to talk about it. So, the point I want to make over here is that the balance between being open about this, that we need to have a conversation about this, I'm not going to be shy, we're not embarrassed to talk about these things, but at the same time, we talk about it in a very modest way, in a not shy that doesn't allow the conversation to happen, mm-hmm. but shy in a way that it's not so open that it becomes...
It raises that gap.
Higher, exactly, right? So we can talk about physical changes that happen at this age. We can talk about things that are related to adult conversation, things that are related to gender interaction, for example, and the sins related to desires, etc. And the words that we use, the tone that we use, even sometimes the pronouns that we use and how we approach this discussion is important, right? Don't just start using terminologies about the different parts of the body, for example, different things that happen in a very open way, that we want to be open and we want to have no shyness and we're just going to talk about it as if I'm talking about it with your friends, for example. No.
Right.
You want to show them that it is very possible to have these conversations, and it's important that we do, But I'm also going to teach you practically of how we talk about these things. There's a level of modesty. There's a level of using particular words and terminology in a way that they are not terminology that might be too open, and we can use other words instead, or we can use a more indirect way to make sure that whilst you understand what I'm talking about, I'm using a more indirect, more softer approach, because this is how we talk about these things. And this type of conversation and discussion with a teenager will lead to a lot of haya, will lead to a lot of modesty, and these positive traits that we need to create in teenagers. Haya and modesty is a very, very important trait that we need to create. This is that positive trait that will ensure that they don't go towards sins, they don't go towards doing certain things that are against the commands of Allah. And so one of the ways to build that is to ensure that when we talk about certain things, we talk to them about it in a very modest way.
Yes, we have to take care of that gap, the haya gap, while having these discussions, so that that trait of modesty remains within our children. And it remains so that so much to the extent, to the level, that they always have this haya when they are lonely as well, not just they have the modesty when they are actually facing certain circumstances. Thank you so much, Brother McDonald, for being with us. Thank you so much to our listeners. If you have any queries or questions regarding the Islamic upbringing of your kids, please feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Just in case you want to listen to our program again, go back to our official website, which is www.parstoday.ir/en. Go to the tab, Call of Islam, and you'll find our programs there. Thank you so much for listening. You were listening to IRIP English Radio. Until another episode, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 31 meters, 9650 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. Israeli genocidal war in Gaza continues for the 216th day, with the focus of attacks not being on Rafah, despite the global outcry. After more than 7 months of onslaught on Gaza, resistance fighters surprise invading Israeli forces with precise missile and sniping operations. Also in the headlines, Colombia's president calls on the International Criminal Court to issue an arrest warrant for the Israeli PM over the genocide in the Gaza Strip. This is news. Thanks for joining us. More than 7 months into the Israeli genocidal war in Gaza, civilians continue to fall victim as the regime keeps targeting residential areas across the besieged territory. In the latest attacks, the regime's warplanes hit a house in the Al-Qasasib neighborhood in the Jabalia refugee camp north of Gaza, killing a journalist along with his wife and son.